Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and, making her debut, Sarah Shepherd of The Coach's Voice. I'll spare you the usual clichés about the Magnificent Seven, but Liverpool are the only team in England with a 100% record. They're feeding off the emotion of the Champions League. The squad is deep, the fans are loud. Their next two league games will tell us everything. Chelsea first, then City. Tasty, eh?
Very tasty, yeah. I can't wait to see these games. Liverpool are not top of the table by fluke. They deserve it. I'm just so impressed by them at the moment. They have improved immeasurably as a team, as a collective this season. So much more depth now, particularly in central midfield. Great tactical options as well for Jurgen Klopp. I think that is maybe the key to their improvement this year. He's obviously boosted the numbers with a number of good additions. But now it's not just a 4-3-3 that has Firmino up the top, Salah and Mane either side. He can mix things up. At the weekend, he had Salah as the number nine, Firmino out on the left. In midfield, he can have any configuration he likes. He's got probably five or six top-class central midfielders. And Shaqiri, we saw come in, gives him a new tactical option. 4-2-3-1, he played in that number 10 role. So look, so much to like about Liverpool. They are in a groove. All of the players are on board with Jurgen's philosophy and they look the real deal to me.
Sarah, you work with coaches and managers, you know, on a daily basis. What do you think are Klopp's greatest characteristics?
I think it's quite easy to see, you know, in interviews that the face that he presents to journalists, to us, is a very open, honest, engaging character. And I think you can't overlook that, you know, the man-management side of things often gets talked about in a bit of a cliche way, but it's so important. And like Adrian said, the players have obviously completely bought into his philosophy. He's managing his team so well. I think this season will be interesting to see how he manages that competition for places. Players like Shaqiri, who's, you know, perhaps, well, we saw him play at the weekend, but he's not going to get that many minutes. Right. And also what happened to him at the weekend, we saw how well he played, but then he has to come off at half-time, which is, like Klopp said, it was a very hard decision. And how is he going to manage that side of things this season? I think that'll be quite interesting.
Absolutely. I think team selection is the one flaw, I would say, in Jurgen Klopp's makeup so far in the Premier League. His over-rotation, particularly at the back, was an issue last season at the start.
This season, though, just to stop you there, only four changes in six games, three of which were against Southampton.
And it helps. It really does. And where they have the big advantage, not over City, but the likes of Chelsea and Arsenal, is that they are the way of playing is so ingrained now in their mind that it all comes naturally. Mm. They don't have to think about it. Whereas the guys at Chelsea and Arsenal, even though they're doing okay, there's so much new information to take on board that I think sometimes it takes them 1 or 2 seconds extra to think, right, yes, at this point I'm supposed to be doing this. For Liverpool, they all know exactly what their roles are.
Mm. Are we likely, you know, obviously, we've got the League Cup, which is, at this stage of the competition, almost an irrelevance. Will we see the reserves in midweek against Chelsea and the proper team, to put it that way, on Saturday the Bridge?
I think you'd be surprised if Jurgen Klopp doesn't make big changes for the League Cup simply because of the games they've got coming up. You know, he's very aware that his front three are, you know, he's going to rely on them a lot this season, and this is an opportunity maybe to give Sturridge another chance, for example. So, yes, I think we probably will, but then But then you think, well, it's still Liverpool-Chelsea, isn't it? And it's still coming ahead of Chelsea-Liverpool at the weekend. And I think there will be an element of Klopp not wanting to cede too much ground or any ground to Sarri before an important league fixture as well. So there's a balance, I suppose, but that's, you know, that'll be something that Jurgen has to get right.
But I suppose if you're Gareth Southgate, you're going to go to one game out of the two. You go to the League Cup tie because you're probably going to see, as you said, Sarah, Sturridge, Solanke, you know, who's meant to be very high in Gareth's thoughts, getting nowhere near it at the moment.
No.
Ruben Loftus-Cheek, maybe someone like, you know, Barclay, even someone like Hudson-Odoi at Chelsea, who's basically been put into the first team squad and disappeared without trade.
Yeah, Danny Drinkwater as well, the forgotten man in central midfield. It's not as if England are flooded with central midfield options. Yeah, it's like an England trial game, isn't it? Takes me back. Yeah, I feel sorry for all of those guys, but the standards are so high now, aren't they, at Liverpool and Chelsea, that they're just not getting a sniff. I feel really sorry for Loftus-Cheek at Chelsea because he did enough last year to suggest that he was good enough to be a Chelsea starter. But unfortunately, the arrival of Kovacic has just absolutely hamstrung him. And unfortunately, he hasn't done enough, has he, to convince Sarri, because it's Barkley that's getting the nod almost every time ahead of him as the first replacement. So, it's a big game for those guys. And it'll be really competitive in that respect. Let's face it, it will be a reserve game.
Mm-hmm. Sarri came out after the game yesterday and talked about Liverpool being a year ahead of his side at the moment. Do you agree with that?
I think a year is... It's quite interesting because Klopp's in his fourth season and Sarri's a matter of months into the role. So a year is possibly even underplaying it. But he obviously has faith in his abilities as a manager to catch up with Liverpool in a year. If he does that, I'll be very, very impressed. It's an interesting thing to say ahead of two games against them. He's obviously, you know, looking to downplay the fact that everyone's pitting Liverpool-Chelsea as a huge game at this point of the season. So... yeah, I think it's an interesting point.
I don't think it's that much in it. I really don't. It's certainly not 4 years. It's not going to take 4 years. I mean, you won't get 4 years. It's Chelsea manager, I'm going to say. It's never going to happen. I'm really impressed by how quickly Chelsea's players have adjusted to Sarri. And I think the key to that, the glue that knits the whole thing together, is Jorginho.
182 passes.
I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Oh, he did most of those passes were quite ineffectual, it has to be said. So I'm not really interested in the fact that he broke that record. But it does show you how much of a conduit he is in that team. They just channel everything through him. It affects the team because obviously Conte's had to be shifted to become a box-to-box player, which you could argue weakens Chelsea defensively. In fact, I would say that Chelsea are weaker defensively because of Conte's positional change. But Jorginho knits it together because you've got a new guy off the pitch in the manager, but he's got a general on the field that knows exactly what his manager wants. And he is the guy, the key man for Chelsea. I think that they've done exceptionally well so far, considering the big changes.
Yeah, and also the fact that they really, up front, they're misfiring to a degree. Is that something that you expect to be redressed in the January window?
I would be surprised if it isn't. I mean, January's always a difficult one in terms of who are you going to get to come in. The advantage that Chelsea maybe do have is that any striker that they're looking to bring in will see that there's an opportunity there for them. Because, like you said, Giroud and Morata aren't exactly lighting things up. I will be surprised because they definitely, we saw against West Ham at the weekend, you know, Hazard is exceptional, but you need someone else in there to get some goals alongside him.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think there's that much of a problem. As long as the others are chipping in, like your Willians and your Hazards in particular. I rate them both. I know they're not having a good time, Morata and Giroud, but when Morata is on it, he's a really good striker, definitely good enough for Chelsea. And Giroud has been exceptional, hasn't he? I mean, he's a World Cup winner. He was superb for Arsenal as a impact sub. I think they'll be fine. I think they'll both get double figures. They won't get 20, but they'll both get into double figures. And what they offer the team, particularly Giroud, with his hold-up play, with his strength in the air, I think it matters. I don't think it's a gimme that they'll look for a new striker in January. Maybe next summer. But yeah, I don't think it's a crisis.
I was interested to see Azpilicueta, who I think's, you know, the epitome of consistency in that side, talk about Hazard being potentially the best player in the world. What do you think, Sarah, does Hazard need to do to actually live up to that ridiculous billing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you look at your Messi and Ronaldo examples and look at them next to Hazard. Obviously, there's the goal factor. He needs to, you know, get on the score sheet a lot more often. But it's also, I'm interested in the attitude side of things. Does he have that same, almost a selfish desire and a hunger to be the absolute best that someone like a Ronaldo has? Mm. You know, Ronaldo, we know with the stories of him being at training.
The 4 a.m. ice bath.
Yeah. Does Hazard have that kind of same motivation, that same hunger? I know he wants to do the best for the team, but does he really want to be the best in the world, you know, as much as Ronaldo does?
I don't think so. I don't think he has that same obsessiveness, does he, to be the supreme individual?
Because he would probably, you know, knowing professional footballers, he would have been, if he had that real hunger and like mega drive, if you like, he would have been hassling people for a move long before, wouldn't he?
Nail on the head. Yeah, if he was as obsessed by Ronaldo and Messi as being number one, top of the tree, he would have demanded a move away from Chelsea. Not this summer, probably the summer before. I think he was the best player at the World Cup, Hazard, as good as Modric was. I think he was the star performer. He is sensational. And when Ronaldo and Messi are gone, the bar for best player in the world will be lowered quite substantially. And I think he's got a genuine chance. I think he is a mesmeric talent. He really is. But Sarah is absolutely right. He hasn't got that drive. I think he's just a relaxed individual. He's just happy to do enough. I think there is more to come from him if potentially this season under a guy like Sarri, who I would imagine is pretty demanding.
Yeah. I find it really interesting, you know, Sarri. If you look at him, we all judge people by, you know, books by covers, don't we? You know, Sarri sort of lumbers in. He's got his packet of fags in one hand. I noticed when the game finished yesterday, his first act was to pick up his cigarettes from the bench. He looks like someone who's just come to clean the boiler. But he's obviously got something about him because, you know, Hazard in particular has been raving about him as a coach.
Yeah, and I've heard from a few people inside Chelsea about what he was like when he first arrived, and some of the little things that he did in terms of the way he interacted with the team were quite clever. He didn't want to be the one giving them sort of bad news or, you know, delivering things that weren't perhaps what they wanted to hear straight away. He had other members of his team do that, so he was very much, you know, wanted to be on side from the beginning. So I think there are definitely lots of clever things about him and the way that he works that we perhaps don't know everything about yet.
It's fascinating. And you've got to admire managers that have come from nowhere, coaches that have come from the bottom of the tree, all the way up. They've earned their stripes. And clearly, he knows exactly what he does. And even though his English isn't brilliant yet, I really enjoy listening to him. He cuts to the chase. And I think he's a really, really good manager. And I can only see good things, really, for Chelsea under him, providing, of course, he sticks around, because not many managers tend to stick around. But Chelsea, I think I said at the start of the season, I think they'd be comfortably third. And I stand by that. I think they are ahead of the likes of Spurs, United and Arsenal this year.
Mm. Let's look a bit at City, Sarah. We saw what happened in the Champions League last week. That a blip or just a taste of something really very surprising to come?
You'd have to think it's a blip, given, you know, their performances last season and again bouncing back at the weekend. Although at the weekend they did have a generally slow start to the game against Cardiff, but then once they clicked into gear, you know, they were just on a different level completely. So I think it's a strange blip because they did look lethargic. They didn't look like the City team that we've become used to seeing, and it's almost more jarring when you see that City team playing slowly.
It gave the likes of, well, not that Liverpool need any clues of how to beat City, they're one of the few teams that kind of got their measure, but it did give a little tactical clue as to how to get at them. And there is a fragility there at centre-half. If you can hassle, if you're bold enough to really get in amongst them inside the City half, pinch the ball and really profit from those turnovers, you can hurt City. They have not got the best defence in the world. They're not even close to having that, are they? But the issue is no one has the ball against them. So I think the Liverpool model, the Lyon model is there for all to see. It's which teams are good enough to replicate it. I think Chelsea might be. I think that they might get there and eventually Arsenal, not at the moment, but eventually they might if Emery's sort of idea about pressing can come to fruition.
I might have to buy a new tin helmet for what I'm about to say, but what struck me most about that game was the sense of complacency on the pitch, but always off it as well. You know, a lot of empty seats, supporters talking after as well, it's only early stage of the Champions League. A city, is the City project actually becoming a little bit too sort of overzealous and overpromoted?
That's interesting, especially in the light of the documentary that we've seen, you know, them becoming this team that's surrounded by twinkling lights and, you know, quite Hollywood style. I mean, the fans not being there is strange. Like you said, it's the start of their Champions League campaign. They, you know, it's something they haven't won yet. You know, surely, and this is a season where they look like they are one of the favourites to win it. why would you not want to be there to see the start of that campaign? So it's odd. And I think even someone at the club said, "Oh, you know, it wasn't exactly a glamour tie against Lyon," which is, like you said, it's a very strange attitude.
It is a strange attitude. They haven't got that many fans, have they? They haven't. I mean, it's true. They didn't get huge support on Main Road. I think they genuinely struggle without tourists coming to Manchester for the weekend. I think they would struggle to sell it out for home games, but which is amazing because they are the best team to watch. I'd pay to go and watch City, no problem at all. But yeah, I wouldn't get hung up on that. I think Pep Guardiola was to blame for the Lyon defeat because he wasn't there. And he wasn't there because he lost his head against Liverpool in last year's quarter final. I think it had a massive effect on the team. It shouldn't have, but it did.
Is there a broader issue here, though? Because, you know, at Arsenal, a club you know well, they came out last week and talked about, you know, a new executive dining club and a little street market in the concourses and all this sort of, you know, modern nonsense.
Yeah.
Is that the world that we are moving into or you've already arrived in?
I'm not hung up on it. If people want to buy those tickets to, you know, be wined and dined and have great food.
Like cheese rooms and things like that.
If fans want to buy them and the clubs wouldn't build these rooms if fans didn't want to buy them or companies didn't want to buy them, so be it. It's a shame for the atmosphere sometimes because you don't want too many people that are not true supporters, that are just there for the fancy meal. I don't think we should be beating up Arsenal or Spurs or City for that. It's just, it's part of the modern game, isn't it? We just got to get on with it. Sadly, that is there to stay. I don't think we're going to go back to the days where it's cheap as chips to go in and every single fan inside a Premier League stadium is you know, is born and bred to support that team.
But you do some really, you know, revealing stuff with lower league coaches and managers. It is a different world, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely so completely different, you know. Going into non-league clubs, obviously, even League Two clubs, even the Cowleys at, you know, at Lincoln, and looking at the facilities that they have, which are brilliant, and they're just building a new training ground, but it's still, you know, it's miles away, even though they're only a few divisions away. It's, you know, different planet.
I went in there and I spent a day with them, and you know, you're sitting at Danny Cowley's desk, and he's got his old Adidas Mundials, which has got mud up to the eyeballs, and you've got a Waitrose carrier bag full of sort of decaying kit, which is basically...
Yeah, but it's Waitrose. It's, you know, it's higher.
but that's the real world. That, you know, at that level, it's the real world, isn't it?
Yeah, and that is why I love to sit... That is why this current England group is so likeable, because a lot of them have experienced that.
Yeah.
Loads have all been on loan at EFL clubs where it's the real world, where you aren't just mollycoddled the whole time. I actually think it should almost be compulsory for our best young talents to experience the EFL at some point because it can do you so much good.
Well, you know, the sort of, you know, best example of that, Harry Kane. You know, all the talk about him being tired, he rejects it. But this week you've got Watford in the League Cup and you've got Huddersfield. With respect to both of those teams, is this the perfect week to say, go and sit on the beach for about 4 days, will you?
Yeah, well, I think so. Whether Harry would agree with that and would go along with that is a different matter. I mean, Pochettino and his staff are, you know, they take great notice of the numbers. They're monitoring everything. So you would think that if they've seen Harry's numbers dropping off, then they would take this opportunity to give him a rest and insist that he has a rest, which as a manager, Pochettino is well within his rights to do. But yeah, Harry is one of those players that he always wants to play. And he did look, in the second half of their game at the weekend, he looked like he was, you know, coming back into a bit more form maybe, but this would be a good opportunity to rest him for sure.
Yeah, well, Spurs need a trophy. You've got to remember that. And it's pretty hard to win the Champions League. Obviously, they might drop into the Europa League where they have a better chance. Realistically, the League Cup and the FA Cup are the best chance. So I wouldn't think they'd go crazy with the rotation. But yeah, I'd leave Harry out. You've got to give Llorente a game at some point, haven't you? Goodness me. I mean, he's barely had a sniff. You've got Son, who could probably do with some games. Moura as well, who's on form. They can get away with it. But I don't know if you're going to ask me about where the game's being played, Mike, but...
It certainly was.
Yeah, well... I think Spurs are... look, it's nothing to do with my Arsenal connections, but I think they're out of order here. I think they should have offered to switch it. I really do. I've got no issue with them playing at Wembley till January, till the end of the season, if they have to. No issue with that at all. Ground's not ready. But to bring in a third stadium, in especially Milton Keynes, which is nowhere near North London, I think it's ridiculous. And they should have offered to forfeit home advantage there. And I'm disappointed that the authorities didn't force them to do it. I think it's a bit of a joke.
So, Sarah, there's a lot of talk, understandably enough, about the delays to Tottenham's new stadium. Doesn't seem to be much transparency from the club itself. Do they actually owe their fans an explanation and an apology?
I think, potentially, yes, they do owe them an explanation and an apology because... You know, we saw in the build-up to the season all the advertising and, you know, pushing the supporters to buy into the new stadium, etc. And they must have known or had an inkling that things weren't exactly on track. And it's not unusual for a big building project like that to be running behind schedule. So I think if they'd have come out earlier and said it, there would have been a bit more understanding from the fans. So maybe, yes, they should probably apologise and be a bit more open about... you know, where things stand.
Do you expect them to play at Wembley for the rest of the season? If so, will that have any material effect on them?
Yes, I do expect them to be playing at Wembley for the rest of the season. Whether it has any effect, well, I think once they know, you know, where they're playing for sure, I think that will actually help the team. You know, if they just come out and said, this is our home now for the rest of the season, rather than be caught in two minds.
I agree, yeah, I agree. I think it'd almost be better. I think the players would almost rather just... say, look forward to next season at the new stadium and just get their heads around being at Wembley.
Yeah. Does it, as a player, you know, we talk about home advantage. Yeah. As a player, how much is that true?
Weirdly, it is true. It's just familiarity, really, with your surroundings. It's no one can explain it. It's just everything feels more natural when you're in your own environment. When you go away from home, it's all alien. Obviously, the noise is against you. It's still the same pitch, it's still the same sport, but it does make a difference. But I don't think it's a detriment to Spurs this season at all. Actually, I think it would damage... I think Spurs have a better chance of finishing in the top four if they stay at Wembley all season than if they switch stadium mid-season. I think that could be really damaging because it's difficult to adjust and it can take time. And you've got to remember that other teams, opponents, always lift themselves when they go to somewhere brand new.
Yeah. Modern world, we've got, we were about a week away from, you know, the headlines that we read about Tottenham being traumatised and Pochettino supposedly under pressure and fans yelling into the void about what a catastrophe it all was. Is it time sometimes just to take a step back and say, look, let's get some perspective here?
I would say yes. Obviously, newspapers need headlines to sell and... Pochettino perhaps didn't help himself with some of his reactions after some of Spurs' defeats. Big picture, you know, it wasn't that long ago that everyone was raving about Spurs and raving about Pochettino's management style. And yes, he has lots of challenges this season. You know, we've talked about the stadium, etc., not buying any players. But, you know, to suddenly lurch from Tottenham fighting for the title and fighting for trophies to saying, you know, they're in crisis is a big leap.
Well, he did actually, he was quoted, wasn't it, saying that we're underdogs in every competition we're in.
I mean, all managers say that, though, don't they?
Yeah, that's a bit defeatist. Do you know what? I think Pochettino's mood, and it is a mood, reminded me a little bit of Antonio Conte last year, which was sour from beginning to end, the bitter end. It did remind me of that. I don't think it's as serious an issue at Spurs with Poch. But the bottom line is, I feel that he feels let down that he wasn't given new players. Spurs weren't anywhere near good enough to win the title last year. How are they going to be good enough this year with no reinforcements? So, yeah, I think Daniel Levy let down his manager in the summer transfer window, and everyone's just getting to terms with that, really.
Mm. I have to admit, when the summer transfer window closed and they hadn't bought anyone, I was kind of... I kind of thought, well, you know, they've got a great team. Yeah. This team has played well together. It's continuity. You know, see how they go and maybe reinforce in January. But now, looking at the squad, I think yes, a few people coming in would have helped.
Liverpool is the prime example. Mm. Liverpool have brought in players to beef up the bench, like Spurs should have done. And the competition for place at Anfield is absolutely fierce at the moment. Mm. So if you play brilliantly, you're not guaranteed to play. It's not the same at Spurs. I think there are too many players very comfortable at the moment, and it's causing a lethargy.
I mean, look at the impact on Milner at Liverpool of Naby Keita coming
exactly.
in. You know, Milner started the season brilliantly.
Yeah.
That just shows, you know, what impact that competition can have.
Big time.
Yeah, yeah. While still going back to Liverpool, you were scouted by Steve Rowley, weren't you, at Arsenal?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Steve Rowley was thrown under a passing bus by John Collins.
Yeah.
Basically saying that he advised Arsenal that Virgil van Dijk was too nonchalant, in inverted commas, for them.
Well, he's a good judge of a player, first of all, let me just say that. And he's a good judge of a centre-half because he also discovered Tony Adams. That was his big scout, Steve's, when he was a young scout. It's taste, I guess, isn't it? I mean, Tony Adams is a case in point. He's not the same style of centre-half. And Virgil van Dijk is a very modern centre-half. He's quite nonchalant, he's quite laid back, but he's got all the tools, hasn't he, to be a fantastic player. I think on that particular story, you can let him off and Arsenal and any other club that passed on Virgil van Dijk, because a step up from Celtic to the Premier League, to the top end of the Premier League, it is fast. There is a reason why not many players make that jump in one go. But there'll be a lot of scouts, a lot of managers absolutely kicking themselves. Personally, I was staggered that more of the big six clubs weren't battering down Southampton's door to sign Van Dijk. It was like an open goal, wasn't it, for Liverpool in the end? And they've been transformed since he came on board.
Mm. But it's all about perception, and the perception, you know, might be that Tottenham is a bit of a selling club. We've had Sun linked to Bayern Munich in recent days. Surely Tottenham can't weaken that squad any further just to boost the bank balance, can they?
You wouldn't have thought so. And if they do that, then I think Pochettino might be pushed over the edge.
They'll all be over the barricades,
yeah,
won't they?
And if Pochettino goes, I think that team are in big trouble. It's funny how the team seem to be... There's a fine line between the continuity, and if they don't win anything and Poch goes and then the team breaks up, you know, there's a very fine line between those two things. Mm. Spurs becoming this, you know, joining the top four as a great club, or falling off the cliff.
Poch is under pressure for his own career, isn't he? Because at the moment, he's just about clinging on by his fingernails to being in part of the elite club, isn't he? Mm. Everyone talks about him being one of the super coaches, which I think, even though I rate him really highly, I think that's still a little bit of a stretch because of his lack of trophies. But he's clinging on. One more season of nothingness at Spurs, where they do well but not well enough. It could see his stock tumble and his prospects of getting a move to your Barcelona, or not go there, but to Real Madrid or wherever wouldn't be realistic.
Yeah.
I don't quite agree with that. I think even if he doesn't win anything this season, I think given the challenges he's facing at the club, I think his stock will still be up there. I could, you know, whatever happens at Manchester United, even potentially see them coming.
But do you realistically think that they would choose Pochettino over Zidane?
Potentially. I mean, given his record with bringing young players through, which is something that Manchester United used to be built upon?
It depends whether that decision is made on footballing reasons or social media penetration reasons, isn't it? Which is what, you know, you're
yeah,
all
about. They're both excellent managers. Look, I'm not having a pop at Pochettino, but I'm just saying his stock is really high for a reason. But one more year of coming up short has to damage his rep a little bit.
I thought, you know, the best moment probably of the season so far for me was at Old Trafford on Saturday when there was that standing ovation given to Sir Alex Ferguson. You speak to coaches and managers all the time. Can you give us an insight into the respect that he is held by his peers?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. So many of them have had interactions with him on some level. Whatever level the manager is at, they have either met with him, they've had advice from him, they've read his book, you know, but they all talk about him. He's just held up as, you know, the kind of the person to aspire to learn from. And he still gives his time up to young managers, even not young managers, but less experienced managers, to offer advice. You know, a couple of the guys we've interviewed at their houses and you see his book in their bookcase and you think, well, these guys do actually, you know, they really revere him.
He's the greatest, isn't he? He's the best we've seen. He's absolutely brilliant. And it was a really great moment, one of the most sort of special moments of the season so far.
Yeah. Which brings us on to the current incumbent, Jose Mourinho. Never happy, it seems. Certainly not happy on Saturday after that 1-1 draw with Wolves. Not enough effort. Discuss.
Not enough effort, yeah. They were not outclassed by Wolves, but Wolves gave them a real good game, didn't they? And it was. I think Wolves will give a lot of big teams a tough test this season. I wouldn't take too much stock by that performance, by that result, because that's a difficult fixture, and it wasn't a huge surprise to me that Wolves looked the equal of Manchester United. There are issues there, we know, at United at the moment. I think the first way to cure whatever is the problem at United at the moment might just be to pick the team based on form. And if you pick the team based on form, Alexis Sanchez is on the bench. I think he'll get more respect from the players if he does that. I think there's a slight issue at the moment whereby Alexis plays no matter what. I know he hasn't played every single game, but there was no justification to pick him ahead of others against Wolves. He picked him, he was poor. I think something's got to change.
831 minutes without a goal and already comparisons being made with Fernando Torres, which is never, ever a good look, is it?
No. A lot of people, you know, you look at his body language and think it's similar to how it was in his last season at Arsenal. I think people forget that in his last season at Arsenal, he wasn't as good as he had been in previous years. He got some very important goals, don't get me wrong, but he wasn't, you know, having the impact on games that he perhaps was earlier in his career. Which is interesting given, you know, he's had this summer off. Yeah. I think people expected a lot more from him and the disparity between what he's offering is quite large.
Maybe he's in a sulk because he didn't get to the World Cup.
Yeah, sometimes you just hit a wall. Fernando Torres did, didn't he? I mean, it's quite spectacular. You know, he went off a cliff, didn't he? But I'm not saying that he's finished. But, yeah, something's not right. I don't know if it's the style of football that Jose Mourinho preaches that's too slow for him. He's a really good player. He's a very dangerous player always. And he'll score goals this year. But unless you pick the first 11 on form, you're not going to have the full respect of your dressing room. If you don't have the full respect of your dressing room, you don't really have a collective team. And I think that is a big issue for Mourinho at the moment.
There's certainly questions about the culture. I found it really interesting that Didier Deschamps was in London on Sunday in a FIFA function, talking about his side that won the World Cup. And he made a special point of basically saying that he looked for a group, and this is the direct quote, who can live together and be united. So in other words, the human chemistry has got to be right. You look at United and you see Pogba, and it's all a war by proxy at the moment of words, and he's talking about attack, 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 knowing that will play well on the terraces. That is the problem with Man United, isn't it? It's not what's going on the pitch per se, it's the whole picture.
The group, yeah. And that's where recruitment comes into it. You know, picking the players that not only are going to give you what you need on the pitch, but who are going to fit into your dressing room and the culture that you want to create. I don't know, has Mourinho managed to create the culture that he would like in that United dressing room yet.
Doesn't feel like it, does it?
No.
No.
The inconsistency suggests...
The Alexis signing kind of mucked things up a bit because...
There wasn't an obvious role for him.
He was on colossal money that was always going to get the backs up of certain high-profile players. And you just wonder, is there room for Pogba and Sanchez in the same team? Potentially, but they don't seem to be all in it together at the moment. It's not a crisis at Man United, not a crisis at all. But when you compare their team ethic with others, i.e. Liverpool, they're quite a way short, aren't they?
Mm. I wouldn't want us to go on without talking about Wolves, because that was a significant performance. They look to me to be one of the best teams to come up in many years. What's the limit, the natural limit of their ambition, do you think?
This season? You look at what Burnley did last season and you think this Wolves team
definitely
looks a better team than that Burnley side. So Europe's not out of the question, I wouldn't think. You know, they've like you said, they've looked brilliant. Haven't looked out of their depth. They've been brave against both Manchester sides, which is something that you don't often see. I guess they've had a lot of investment, but Nuno's managed to gel his new players with the ones he brought up.
Yeah, exactly. Chemistry and fluency and flow and all those things. It comes from time. They've been together. They know what the manager wants. I think the contrast was there for all to see at Old Trafford. United, still a team of individuals to some degree, and Wolves, a proper team, all on the same page. Very impressed. I think I said it before the start of the season, 7th or 8th, and I'm definitely sticking with that.
What's your progress report on Arsenal? Decent win over Everton. Probably stressed the importance of that front too, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Lacazette and Aubameyang are going to be crucial, aren't they, to Arsenal this season? Although, it's a really wide net of goal scorers, I have to say, at Emirates Stadium this year. Work in progress. So far, so good. I like a lot about what Emery's bringing in. I like the energy. They're working much harder. They're trying to press from the front. You see exactly where he wants the team to go. I don't think he's nailed his best 11 yet. I don't think he's even nailed his best formation. There's a little bit of imbalance. You've got Ramsey in the 10 role, where I don't think he's had his most effective. You've got Ozil on the right, and he wants to be in the number 10. You've got Aubameyang on the left. He wants to be up top. It's not quite right at the moment, but Arsenal are getting away with it because they've got talented individuals. I see lots of positives. The one big fat negative, clearly, is that there's been no visible sign of improvement at the back. Real struggle. Mm. And they're conceding too many shots. I think Petr Cech has been the third busiest keeper in the Premier League, which tells its own story.
Mm. Cech has been under a lot of criticism. And he is learning to play from out from the back. That performance, I thought, had great character against Everton. You know, the one thing is, you can see his stature as a man and a human being actually coming over into his work on the football pitch.
Yeah, and it was interesting in his interview after the game. He was captain, wasn't he, at the weekend? Mm. And he actually brought that up in his post-match interview. He said, I'm captain, I've got to be the leader and I'm the senior member of the squad as well. So he's obviously, he's using that responsibility in a good way to almost help him fulfil his role. And I thought, he had a great game. I mean, he was called upon a hell of a lot. But it was, he's definitely looked much more comfortable the last couple of years.
One of the biggest red herrings of the season so far has been Cech should be dropped. It was ludicrous that people were saying this on the basis of one or two bad passes. And yes, he did make bad passes. He did look a bit uncomfortable. But if you are grading him alongside every other goalkeeper in the Premier League in goalkeeping or in the art of stopping shots, Cech has been in the top three keepers in the Premier League this season. His form is so much better than it was before Bernd Leno came in. He's had a prod and he's responded to it like every top player should.
Mm. But as Aid says, the defence is worrying, and you can see someone like Deeney, they're playing Watford at the weekend, really causing problems. Mustafi, to me, looks like an accident waiting to happen every game.
Yeah, I think Troy Deeney will be licking his lips at the thought of playing Arsenal again, absolutely. And you know exactly what he's going to do. You know, he makes no secret about it. He wants to pressure pressure players, you know, go at them in the first few minutes and see what effect it has. And you just wonder if after the last couple of seasons, his success, you know, that will have got in the likes of Mustafi's head a bit. I thought Holding did well when he came on at the weekend, so potentially it could be a place for him.
Well, they're bold, aren't they, Watford? Front two this year, which is really good to see. I love seeing managers play with strike force. It's like the old days. But it's not to the detriment of them at the back. So, as a front two, the Gray's movement, I think, will be a real problem as well for Arsenal. Opposition teams have been running in behind the back for fun, way too easily. I think Watford on the counter when they go direct from back to front down the sides will cause Arsenal problems in this game. And they could in effect nullify the impact that Lucas Torreira is having, which is as a really good shield in front of the back four. But I think what Watford will do, they'll look to turn Arsenal at every opportunity. And I think it could be a high scoring game.
In that build-up to the Everton game, obviously there was a lot of focus on Theo Walcott. Mm. And it did surprise me when he said, I fell out of love with football at Arsenal. Were you surprised by that?
No, because... Well, yes and no. But I say no because when you're not playing, you hate it. It's horrible. you get paid a lot to be a professional footballer, but when you're not picked on a Saturday or a Wednesday or whatever, and you're continually overlooked, it just plays with your head. And I've been through it, I've experienced it myself, and it knocks your self-esteem. And, honestly, the psychological damage that footballers can go through, and it's easy to say, oh, you get paid a lot, you should be above that. But it does. If you're a sensitive person, your confidence can be affected greatly. And I think Theo is of that ilk. I'm not surprised he fell out of love with football. He just wanted to play.
But I partly think some of that was possibly his fault. I think he probably should have left a couple of seasons earlier than he did. Mm. He was very comfortable there, which isn't always a good thing. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Mm. But I think for a player of his age and the length of time that he'd been at Arsenal, he had to leave for his own career, which he did eventually, but he should have done it.
I do agree, yeah. I think Theo should have left a couple of years before. But look, he's enjoying himself. He's a main man for Everton now. He's a good player. I think Theo Walcott has overachieved. I've said this before. I think he's for his talent, he's actually overachieved in his career. A lot of people will go the other way and say he didn't fulfil his potential. I think he did. I just don't think he was ever as good as some people made him out to be. He's just really good at running in behind and finishing off chances. And for him to stay at Arsenal on the back of that for so long, I thought was a good achievement. Mm.
Everton at the weekend are at home to Fulham. Mitrovic scored again against Watford at the weekend. Is he shaping up to be Rafa Benitez's biggest mistake at Newcastle?
It certainly looks that way, and I think anyone who's got Mitrovic in the fantasy team will be very happy to see his form continue, because he's clearly going to get a lot of goals this season for that Fulham side. It's hard to understand why Benitez didn't fancy him. I know he had, people talked about his character initially, but I think he's really matured. And he looks to be enjoying that responsibility that he's got at Fulham. Jukanovic obviously trusts him implicitly, and he knows what he delivers. You know, he's strong, he's powerful. He's a great front man.
That's brilliant. Yeah, I think his success at Fulham is a prime example of how important a player's relationship is with the manager, because Jukanovic and Mitrovic, they know each other. They know which buttons to press. It works. Rafa, who we know is aloof, just didn't get him, I guess. I don't know. It is guesswork. You have to get him on the coach's voice to speak to him. Because Rafa's clearly a master tactician. How can he prefer Yosselu? Even Rondon?
He started with Aion. So I was at the game on Saturday and it was dreadful. All three of them couldn't kick their way out of a paper bag at the moment. They're all over the place. Yeah. And I suppose that then heightens the issue. There was a lot of attention on Saturday that Mike Ashley turned up at his first Newcastle game for 16 months. Mm. Fans are in open revolt. Rafa, to me, is there under sufferance. Where's it all play out for Newcastle?
Yeah, it's difficult to see Rafa being there beyond this season. At the moment, his quotes after the game were quite interesting in that he was pleased to see Mike Ashley there. You know, he wants his support. He wants him to show, he wants him to see what he's got on the pitch, especially. He made sure to say that, which is quite interesting. But yeah, it's very hard to see Rafa continuing there after this season. I think his stock is still very high as a manager. Everyone respects how difficult his job is there. So yeah, well, hopefully he can keep them up. But either way, I don't really see him being there.
OK, well, a few questions from the viewers and the listeners. Ben Archer, how long can Chelsea get away with Luiz at centre-back?
I don't think he's been that bad, genuinely. Like, I prefer him in a back three. I think he's still got the potential to be an outstanding defensive midfielder, but I don't think his form's that bad. And he's in the team on merit.
Sarri obviously wants him there to be able to take the ball out into midfield. That's the style of play that he likes.
Absolutely. I don't see a massive issue. One day, in the not-too-distant future, Ethan Ampadu will come in because I think he would be so good that he can't be ignored any longer. But for the moment, if I was Chelsea manager, I'd pick Luiz.
Right. You're not, though. Right. Derek Dryden, Sarah. Another Arsenal, or an Arsenal fan, with the new players we've got, how long do you think it will be before we engage with Emery's vision and defend cohesively as a team? Is it a time issue or a player quality issue?
I think in terms of defending cohesively as a team, I think it's both. I think we do need a bit of reinforcement defensive, you know, especially in the centre of defence. In terms of buying into his vision, I think that's a time thing. Hopefully the players, and I think you've seen that they do want to buy into his vision. It's just going to take, you know, Wenger was there for 20-odd years. It's going to take time for things to change on the pitch.
Yeah, the habits need to change. In terms of the defence, it's a player issue, in my opinion. I think we've seen enough already. We haven't seen a big improvement from certain individuals. Upgrades are needed in that department.
Another Arsenal question. Ian Westwell, which youngsters at Arsenal could be playing regularly in the first team in the next few years?
You see, this it changes because it's very difficult to tell because it's so hard to break into a team like Arsenal. Emil Smith Rowe is the standout youngster at the moment. He's just turned 18. And he's a wonderfully gifted player. He reminds me of Kevin De Bruyne stylistically, in terms of he can play wide or as an attacking midfielder. He's got a great turn of pace, really quick feet, wonderfully balanced player. He's got it all. The one issue against him is that it's the competition for places. The guys in his spot are excellent players. Ozil, Mkhitaryan, Aaron Ramsey, Alex Iwobi to a certain degree. It's tough, but He's the most gifted of the current generation.
What about Maitland-Niles? I know he's been out with a broken leg, but before that he was
on the cusp of. He's got an opportunity at left back, a central midfield. He hasn't grasped it, unfortunately. The opportunities, I mean, just a bit too laid back for me, Maitland-Niles. I think if he can really sharpen up his mind, and I think Emery will do that. Then he's got potential. He's got the tools. Yeah. He's got the athleticism. Yeah. He's got the ability. But yeah, we will see. The other one is probably Eddie Nketiah, who's a natural born finisher. Mm. Again, will he get the opportunities? Yeah. Maybe if Lacazette.
I know a lot of scouts at Championship clubs have been trying to get him on loan.
Yeah. Well, Arsenal aren't blessed with, unfortunately, a lot of backup strikers. You've got Danny Welbeck, of course. But Eddie Nketiah might be needed this season. So I don't see him going out before January.
Right. Right, final question, and I better give you a bit of background about this one. It's from Keelan McCaffery. Sorry, McCafferty, beg your pardon. He's a Manchester United fan, came on last week and basically said we have an agenda against Manchester United, which is absolutely true.
John Cross does, doesn't he?
Yeah. he says, look, it's a tad early, but what are everyone's top four predictions in order and who are the relegated three? So it's make your mind up.
I said at the start of the season it'd be City, Liverpool, Chelsea. I could flip Liverpool and City, but I'm not going to yet. But yeah, I'll stick with what I said. I think City, it'll be a really close race this time. City to win, Liverpool second, Chelsea third. Then I think there's a bit of a gap. I genuinely, and I know it sounds like I'm sitting on the fence, genuinely think there's going to be 2 or 3 points between Arsenal, Spurs and United. But I'm not going to back against against my boys. I think they will get better as the season goes along, Arsenal. And I think they might pinch fourth, but maybe that's wishful thinking.
And bottom three?
Well, I said Cardiff and Huddersfield in the pre-season show, and I'm 100% sticking with that. I also said Watford, which is leaving me with egg on my face. Watford will be all right. You know what? It's Newcastle. I don't see enough firepower, and I think the injury to Lejeune at the back was really critical. He had a good thing going with Lascelles, and I don't think that that defence is great without Lejeune in there, so I'm going to say Newcastle.
Sarah?
I'm going to go with Liverpool, not just to be different, but I genuinely think the feeling around the team, the depth they've got, the way that they're all buying into Jürgen, I just think that could be enough to carry them over. Also, the little holes we've seen in City and focus on the Champions League, etc. So, yeah, I'm going to go Liverpool, City, Chelsea, and I'm actually going to go United.
I think you'd like that one, Keelan. Anyway, my top four, Liverpool, City, Chelsea and Spurs. Bottom three, Southampton, Huddersfield and Cardiff. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.